Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
The lag from inflation, insurance policies are going up, taxes are going to go up across the board this year. So you've got less revenue coming in, but that inflation and that lag, especially in insurance and a lot of our basic costs for living, are continuing to go up. So this is not a good environment that we're walking in that you want to be speculating that we're going to thread this needle perfectly.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and today we're going to be discussing maybe this is a time for caution, and if you have a portfolio, if you have wealth in the markets, we're going to talk about why now is a good time to be maybe a little cautious, or at least make sure you have a risk-managed approach on your portfolio. Of course, discussing this with us, Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing good, Chris. I'm a little amazed at a little bit of the foolishness that's out there right now, but doing well.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is... Listen, I'm a big believer that we're in bubble territory, and it's not even a belief, actually. It's just you look at the charts. It's obviously a bubble across all sorts of sectors. So we're going to dive into a little bit of that. But first, Paul, I was thinking if we could just talk about why maybe it's a time for caution. And you know what? Here's what bothers me, Paul. What bothers me is that what always happens at bubbles, this isn't my first rodeo. I was there trading actively during the 2000 bubble, got my rear handed to me. I was there for the 2007-08 housing bubble, did much better during that one. So I've seen this before. I've seen where we're at before. And you know what always happens right towards the end? Retail throws their last caution to the wind. I don't know what articles they write or how many Jim Cramer episodes, but they just come rushing in and then the rug gets pulled and darn their luck. They lose all their money. And so that's what I'm worried we're seeing. So I just came across this, which was put out pretty recently. And this is flows by ETF categories, okay? So you have individual investor ETF flows. And you can just see these, Paul, this is billions. That's 200B, B with the B billion, right? Since the beginning of this year, and we're in August now, this you can just see these massive, like, inflows by retail coming into ETFs. Corporate bond ETF flows, much more muted, as you might expect. They're up, but what's that, maybe $20 billion across the whole year? But professional investors have ETFs they use. Paul, they're opposite. They're down $40 billion. So it's retail versus the pros. I think we've seen this story before.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, we've seen it before. I mean, you've got the perfect environment right now to set up retail. You've got private equity that's marketing, trying to find an exit like crazy. Mm-hmm. They're spending lots of money on advertising. And as soon as there's a gentleman that's actually started or starting, hopefully it's going to come up in the next 90 days, a website to show stock promotion strategies, because, you know, there's people that have to get rid of big positions and then they'll go promote those stocks to push them out on retail. So we've just got an environment right now where, what's the scripture in the Old Testament? My people die for lack of knowledge. And I'm sure I butchered that because it just came to mind. But the reality is the average retail investor just doesn't understand valuations like they should. They don't understand how expensive the market is. It's kind of like Sven Hendricks put out on that tweet we mentioned a month or two ago. You know, why is the market going up? Well, it's going up and people are buying it because it's going up. And they're fully convinced at this point that it's never going to go down again. You know, the AI theme has been something that's just got people charged, even crypto. I mean, one thing that's interesting to me is if crypto was a true gold version, you know, digital gold, then I don't see the big firms marketing these ETFs and trying to gather assets into the gold ETFs or recommending that you go out and buy them and, you know, buy physical gold. But boy, there's a lot of marketing taking place by the ETF companies and these new issuers of these crypto ETFs. And they've got the perfect environment to gather assets. Because retail is just as euphoric as they can possibly be. And you know, I feel sorry for them for what's coming.
Me too. Me too. And you mentioned the AI thing because, you know, obviously we're in a big AI bubble. And by the way, it has all the hallmarks of a bubble, right? So my definition of a bubble, Paul, is when asset prices rise beyond what incomes can sustain. So that just means you get out really crazy far in front of your earnings and you see these crazy earnings multiples, 100, 150, 200, right? More. And that's insane because, you know, this company has to put on the longest uninterrupted earnings bonanza ever to justify that. But of course, you know what happens in between there and there? Competition. Somebody says, wow, that looks profitable. I'll do that too, you know? So you don't have 30 years of 20% income growth, you know, all to yourself. Just doesn't work out that way. But it's the story of AI. I'm wondering, it's always dangerous to say that it's over, but you know, they're starting to, this just came out in the Financial Times. They're saying, hey, you know, are U.S. tech stocks hit by concerns over future of AI boom? Right? So we're starting to see the questions in the Financial Times, right? I didn't know this. I ran across this the other day by Zoomer. And this is a very long, you could follow that link down there, anybody who wants to. It's probably a 15, 20 tweet thing. I just pulled the first one. But he said, you know, AI is a house of cards because one, you pay $200 a year for an AI app like Cursor. Then Cursor pays OpenAI $500 for API tokens, which they have to burn to generate the queries and all that. $300 of which is VC funding. Then OpenAI pays AWS, Amazon Web Services, $1,000 for compute, $500 which is VC funding. And then AWS pays $10,000 for more NVIDIA GPUs, you know? That's classic.
That is classic. With a product that's ultimately going to be deflationary if it's as successful as what they think it's going to be. So there's going to be less income and less employment for the individuals that are out there that are consuming. You know, that's going to put the straps to the U.S. consumer if it's actually successful in increasing unemployment.
Well, and then you might have seen this, too. There was this MIT study that came out, and they said, well, So there's two ways to look at this. There are these large language models, which I think we can all agree they do a good job writing college essays and helping us craft a better email and all that. Those have use, and they're going to steal jobs. But U.S. companies have been trying to figure out how to get generative AI into their businesses, and they've invested $35 to $40 billion, it says here. And then according to this report bought from MIT's NENDA, Network Agents and Decentralized AI, NENDA, 95% of enterprise organizations have gotten zero back from their efforts so far. 5% have gotten something successfully in there, but 52 structured interviews they conducted with enterprise leaders, analysis of 300 public AI initiatives and announcements, a survey of 153 businesses, and they found just 5% of them were working. So I'm just saying it might be more of a slog than we thought. You know, you don't just sort of like park these things and wrap them into your business. And it just works quickly. So that's what happens when you have the rocket ride of this boom will never go. Chris, you don't understand. Railroads are going to unlock new territories and all this stuff. You know, there will never be a shortage of demand for the Semper Augustus tulip bulbs that we have over here.
Well, and back in the internet bubble, tech bubble, you know, 1.0 for this period of time, it was about eyeballs, right? Oh, how many eyeballs they're getting in there. And just assuming that was going to continue to translate into profit and the benefit of hindsight, we know exactly what happened on the other side of that. So fascinating.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting report. I had seen it and I'm still shocked by the fact that only 5% of the companies have been able to, and MIT's got some connections, right? I mean, they're interviewing these powerful companies that have the capital to put in there. So how much longer are they going to continue to throw money at it, hoping that it's going to produce something?
I don't know. But if it's a longer slog, it means it's just, you know, it's not like exponential growth for as far as the eye can see. That sort of, once it becomes a slog, you know, people rationalize it. 35, 40 billion is nothing to sneeze at, all that. The other part that was, I don't think was fully thought through, which you and I have talked about, was apparently it really did send some shockwaves with the DeepSeek that came through. And the problem is that China now has the lead in open source AI. And the reason it jolts Washington was because, well, it looked like China was very clever and did some awesome stuff. And Silicon Valley got jolted because, you know, Paul, it's kind of hard to extract your rents, your fees from people when they have access to the same stuff for free.
Right.
Kind of breaks the model down just a little bit.
It sure does. Well, and look, they can't use the capital that they've accumulated over the past 20 years to buy up all of the programmers and the talent that's there if it's out there, because there's somebody that they overlook that's going to introduce a product that's going to be better in a source like that. So it's going to be interesting how this unfolds.
But I mean, it's exciting. It's going to do a lot of things. We're starting to just start to see the downside of this. And, you know, a couple, not this week, but last week, Evie and I talked about how, you know, people are falling in love with their AI chatbots. And it's like we're starting to understand there's some dark side to this whole thing that's not quite what we thought it was. So at any rate, you know, it was supposed to solve everything. And now we're starting to confront the reality of it a little bit. And that's the right. One thing bubbles hate is reality. They hate it.
They don't like reality. And we're in a world that doesn't love the truth. So it's easy to deceive the masses for a period of time.
Yep.
Now, I will say one thing, as far as AI and especially Grok, it has saved me tons of data input time. So, for example, I had somebody send me a picture of transaction histories because they weren't able to upload something. That didn't have client account numbers or anything like that on it, but I needed to convert it to a spreadsheet. So I was like, Grok, can you take this photo and convert it into an Excel spreadsheet? 5 seconds later, it was into an Excel spreadsheet, probably saved me 20 minutes worth of input time. So there are incredible time-saving benefits that come out of it, and you can access information at your fingertips a lot quicker, but it saved me some time. So maybe that saves one employee if you continue to grow as time goes along, because there's things that you can do quicker that you're delegating there. But I haven't found turn a key and it's going to generate incredible profits at this point.
Maybe it will. But point is, you know, as soon as you get to just a little reality in this story and, you know, budgets aren't infinite, then I think, you know, we find out that maybe NVIDIA isn't worth as much as all the companies in Germany combined.
Is it time to show that NVIDIA chart?
Yeah.
Is it time to show that NVIDIA chart, Chris?
I do, because that one scares me. I don't like super steep roller coaster rides, you know?
This one is just, every time I look at it, it just amazes me. I mean, and you watch it and you see, but this is NVIDIA Weekly going back to October of 2018. I mean, look at the move that's occurred since the, you know, tariff tantrum bottom that occurred in April. Just poof, and it better be different this time. It better be different.
Wow.
This time. That's a lot of future growth priced in right there.
Yeah. Well, now, so one of the things that could cause companies to maybe tighten the belts a little bit and not have infinite money to throw at any project they want is a recession. And last time we talked about all these recession indicators you and I saw, we saw there was labor market weakness, there was some stuff in housing we had to look at, there was a few flashing signs in cardboard, and of course the stripper indicator, right? All these things sort of saying, hey, you know, there's clear signs of recession. I think there's a couple more we should talk about. These are anecdote level, but this is often where we find good information. This DAYE, Day, I'll call him, said, my friend's wife is an escrow closer at a big title and escrow company. She typically closes 25 to 30 files a month. As of now, there's nothing booked for September. Zero closings on the book for the next month coming, the front month.
Wow. That doesn't surprise me based on what I'm hearing around the country, though. But that is shocking that a large title and escrow company has nothing coming up, because you got to put those on the calendar. You can't do them next day, typically.
Yeah. And Nemo, in response to that, said, as a small manufacturer, I ship daily with Old Dominion, a trucking company. A regular driver told us today, last Friday, his terminal told 8 out of 25 drivers to stay home, which is unheard of in the summer. So,
wow.
Trucking's a pretty important indicator to me. I look carefully in the trucking and cardboard industries for these early signs, because often that's the first place you see it.
It's trickling through, but the market, it could care less about this data. It just could care less about the data at this point. The market's supposed to be forward-looking. And there are periods of time where the market is forward-looking, but when you get into bubbles, it's looking forward and seeing Goldilocks in every scenario. And it's looking at Goldilocks and recognize she's got gold lace clothes on, wearing gold shoes and a purse full of gold while she's walking down, because they can't imagine that there's going to be any negative outcome that can come at this point. They're all in, and they're having to convince themselves that they're not speculating, that they're investing, when in reality they're speculating.
Well, you know, it's a kind of a regional thing, but this guy, Ryan LaRue, said he's out west. So I think he's Utah, California, and New Mexico, I think. Anyway, he said it's a race to the bottom in roofing right now for the last 30 to 60 days. Cheapest bids are what wins, from homeowners, builders, and commercial property owners, all three. It's almost solely about price, which makes sense. We just submitted a bid for a roof in Utah for $43,000 in new construction. It was on a $1.3 million house, I found out later. We cut our margins a bit, knowing we were up against several others and also trying to win this particular builder. They accepted a bid, cheapest guy, of course, for $25,000. For perspective, that barely covers the materials on this type of job, but leaves no room for labor cost or margin. Wow, times are changing quick in this business. We'll have to adjust strategy as this progresses further. And deeper in that thread, again, the link's down below, he sort of broke it down even further. And I was like, yeah, no, I mean, this guy knows his biz. There was no way they could have matched that bid. Not a chance.
No.
So somebody's pretty desperate or didn't know what they were doing.
Hey, and that's the thing. We saw this, and after 2007, 2008 started turning, you know, people were doing jobs at losses just to create cash flow to float the debts that they had accumulated in the interim period, just to try to hold on a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows whether they just absolutely underestimated it's a new business, but they didn't understand the market if they were that much below it.
Or they were that desperate, like you said. Don't know. Yeah. We'd have to look at those particulars. But I thought that comported when I found that, because I was searching around for more housing stuff, because I read this. This is from today, that James Hardy makes Hardy Plank. I put Hardy Plank on a couple of my houses. Good product. The stock collapsed 35%, so much for forward-looking.
Yeah.
The stock market all of a sudden figured out with their rearview mirror that this was not going well. But yeah, big, big weakness in the U.S. housing market, and homeowners reluctant to spend on big projects. So again, that's very consistent with recession.
It sure is.
Good recession indicator.
We're seeing all kinds of signs. This environment reminds me, now I don't know if it's going to be as severe as what 2008 was, but you know, late 2007, early 2008, the bank stocks, especially local bank stocks, were all the rave. And it was just mathematics. And I started talking to people. I'm like, hey, you know, I know you've got legacy positions that you've owned for a long time, but unless you're willing to ride that position down 50%, you should trim some profits off of it at the top. So I actually get a phone call from one of the local banks that says, Paul, if you don't stop telling people to sell the local bank stock, I'll run you out of town.
And really?
Yeah. Well, I should have told what's before that. He called my father and had my father call me and say, hey, you need to stop doing that. I'm like, I can't. This is just mathematics. When we run a risk managed strategy, you know, people need to get out. So I had a lower price target if things kind of go back to normal. Ultimately, they went bankrupt. And then ultimately, you find out that the president of the bank had been doing some shady things and was trying to do everything that he could do to keep it going a little bit longer because he had a vested interest in keeping it in place. Now, to be fair, you know, the government did use that as an opportunity to reduce the number of banks that are out there, because there's things they could have done to support those small community banks instead of hand them over with guarantees to these larger companies. But this does remind me of that environment. Nobody wants to hear any negative news right now. And they'll, you know, they'll try to argue with you, and you show them the data and they just don't want to see it. You know, you look back and say, this is the most expensive market in history by the culmination of measures, but they're going to look to that one that says, yeah, that one indicator is in the 95th percentile. you know, so there's more room for it to go without, you know, and I don't know, but that's what happens. You know, that's the mm-hmm. reason why I've got that picture of history of bubbles back there to remind me and to remind clients. We've been here before. This is nothing different, right?
Mm-hmm.
The one thing, the first time I read the Bible front to back when I was younger, you see the nation of Israel is blessed. God's people are blessed because they're doing the right things. And then as they get blessed, they become weak. They give in to the base human desires, and then society collapses. And it's this cycle that we go through throughout history. History documents it in every circumstance. Markets are documented. But the problem is, today, we naturally think we're wiser, smarter, and more educated, and we're not going to make the same mistakes that they did in the past.
This time is different?
Yeah, this time is different.
Yeah.
But we're smart enough and educated enough that you don't say it out loud, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I had a similar sort of an experience. It's 2007. This is before the crash course is done, and before I've written a book or gotten the video series out. So I'm giving local talks, and I'm at Brattleboro, Vermont, and I'm at the Chamber of Commerce, right? And a bunch of people there, and they had the breakfast, and then this guy, Chris, is going to talk. And I just pointed out all my data that there was a housing bubble, right? And nobody wanted to hear that. And there were these two guys, you know, they were just frowning at me with their arms crossed. They followed me out into the parking lot afterwards, and they wasn't violent, but they were very upset. They're like, you don't know what you're talking about. You shouldn't be saying stuff like that. If you don't have, how many years have you been a realtor? And I'm just like, dude, it's just data, you know?
Yeah.
They were pretty unhappy with me, right?
Right. Hey, you put out some great stuff back then because I found one of the articles that you had published somewhere at the time. I can't remember. And I took that and I was like, Chris laid this out and, you know, here's the data, you know, and it helped convince clients to lower their risk and get themselves resilient. And I was bearish, but I wasn't bearish enough as to what actually unfolded and how quickly it unfolded back then.
Yeah.
You know, and just to remind listeners, I mean, market peaked in November of 2007 and then had a sell-off into February, had a little bit of a rally. Oil prices took off. What they went from, what, $60 to $130 or $140 a barrel by summer of 2008. And then everything came apart after that, going into the November of 2008, a year later. And nobody believed that it could happen. But the worst part of the damage to individual investors didn't really occur until, you know, 2009, 2010, where all of those loans started being called and weren't renewed. And then people were forced out of their positions at the worst time because they weren't resilient and they weren't prepared. So, yep. You know, that's what you're warning people about. And I am too, for you listeners out there right now, when everybody thinks it's different this time and the math doesn't make sense to justify where the market is, that's the time that you need to sweep some off, set some aside, and just build some resiliency. You might, maybe you're bulletproof, right? That your portfolio can go down 50% and you'll never be forced to sell. Good for you if you are, but that's not the case for the average person. And I work with people who have resources and we analyze, and there's very few people that can weather a major downturn. So don't get yourself in a position where you're forced to sell at the worst time. It takes discipline and it takes courage, but everything good in our lives takes discipline, sacrifice, and courage. So if you've accumulated resources, you've done without in the past and lived a little bit lower of a lifestyle than what other people did so that you can have a better and more freedom in the future. You know, money can't make you happy, but if it's managed wisely, it can give you freedom that you otherwise wouldn't have. So take that same courage and discipline of where you are right now to, you know, take that path less traveled, sweep some off the top, diversify into something that's a little bit more resilient, and get something that could be protected in case the market comes apart. Because look, you know, Chris, you just showed the retail numbers. The average retail person's all in. The professionals have been selling to retail. So where's retail going to buy a big decline and turn it into a once in a lifetime opportunity if they're all in right now? Okay. Those professionals are setting money over to the side so that when that opportunity comes, I mean, take Buffett. Everybody respects Buffett. I mean, he has so many wise quotes because he takes the complicated and narrows it down to one sentence of a quote or two sentences or a short paragraph that gets to the heart of the matter. And by their strategy, they've got the largest cash hoard of an investment company right now that we've seen in history. Do you think they're going to be in a position to take advantage of opportunity? And if they didn't think that this was a risky time, why would they be raising that capital? Because they're paying attention to the fundamentals. They've studied history enough to understand that it's not different this time. And they've been successful because they've been able to control their emotions over that fear of missing out. And they're making logical decisions instead of emotional decisions. And they could care less what their brother-in-law is doing because they know that the path that they're walking on is prudent. And if the information changes, they'll change their stance. But all the information that we have right now is telling us you better be careful, because if you're not, you're speculating that it's different this time. And maybe it is completely different this time, but those cycles, maybe valuations stay higher. But that doesn't mean that we're never going to go down again, at least until we become the Weimar Republic and there's laws that says you can't sell on a downtick in the market, and we're not there yet.
Well, there is one way we could say it's kind of different. It's been different since 1971, which is that the banks and the Fed are no longer constrained at all by anything to just create more money, more loans, whether they're loaning it to the government as the borrower of last resort, you know, or they're whatever they do, they will. So I'm sympathetic to the idea of people saying, Chris, even if we have a downturn, the Fed's just going to paper it over. Now, the problem I have with that is that, like in this example where there's this roofer, right, and there's this guy who's underbidding, let's 25K. Maybe he's desperate, but let's imagine he's just a moron. Okay, he should go out of business, right? That's what should happen. But when there's credit everywhere and banks eager to loan, you know what? This guy could probably go get a loan, get an extension. We have now, Paul, last count, 1 in 6 small companies in America is a zombie company, too laden with debt to move forward. Now, what's supposed to happen is a recession. You clear that out. Some people take some losses, but then the better companies, they survive and they step in there. And those are the ones that should survive. I think it's kind of like if you had a wildebeest herd with no predators. Eventually, it becomes kind of sick and lame and, you know, not all that magnificent. Like you need recessions are they're good. We've demonized them. Like, oh, we can't have one anymore. So I found this super fascinating. Somebody plotted out recessions, and there have been 34 since 1855. This is a chart. Every one of those bars is a year. We go back to 1855 all the way on the left, and the blue is when we're expanding, and the pink is when we're contracting. And you can see, like, there were some nasty periods. Like, this is like a 5-year contraction back here. That was pretty bad. Right?
Was that 1875? That was a depression somewhere around there. That may have been that depression.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. U.S. longest recession lasted 68 months. Oh my God.
Wow.
5 years. But the point here is that you can sort of see it's kind of like breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. The forest grows, it has a little fire, it grows a little more, it has a little fire, whatever your metaphor is. And then look what's happened lately. See all this blue territory down here? Because the Fed just won't allow recessions to exist anymore. And this is the shortest recession on record right here, which is our 2020 mini recession from COVID. But that was it. It's over before it began because they printed out of it. I see all this blue, Paul. It's just a lot of dry tinder. Like, that's why I think they're afraid to let an actual recession get started, because if that forest floor catches fire, I think it burns the whole thing down, is what they're afraid of.
Yeah,
right.
That's absolutely what they're afraid of. Well, you go back to prior to, I can't read the bottom of the chart there, but what, 1932, when the gold, when the government, you know, outlawed the ownership of gold,
pulled all the U.S.
coins came back in. Then they started expanding the money supply,
which is right in here.
In 1971, what was it, Bretton Woods? Was it 71 or 72, Chris, where Nixon left the gold standard?
71 is when we left the gold standard. 44 right here is when we would have gotten Bretton Woods in.
Yes.
So it didn't even last all that long.
So now we were responsible, and then we started utilizing credit as our government, and that's continued to expand. But at some point, that debt's going to collapse in on itself. So, yeah, you can kick that can down the road for a while, much longer than anybody can anticipate, but you're not going to absolutely remove the pain that's a part of our economic cycle of destruction and recreation on the other side of it. to an extent, recreation. But so, and mm-hmm. that's the thing that makes this so hard for the average individual, because they're looking back and going, well, if I had them, they're going to Instagram, Facebook, movies. They're looking at all this stuff, and they're marketed this lifestyle that you know, they believe is the American dream. And it's just, you know, they're chasing something else out there without understanding the risks that they're carrying in the interim period. Because everywhere you go, there's a feedback loop, and the natural thing that we all have is confirmation bias. And there's everywhere that you can confirm, you know, everywhere I look out there, I look hard to try to see what everybody's seeing. And you can be confirmed that the markets will never go down again anywhere you look.
The markets are nothing if not, they feast on liquidity, right? And so I think that's that blue area. The Fed's just been like, all the central banks just throw money into the markets, and hopefully that cures things. And as you've talked about, right, it sort of does. It kind of keeps the appearance, but it's like eating Wonder Bread only as a dietary thing and catches up with you, right? And so now we have the biggest wealth gap ever, and we've left whole portions of our generations aside. And, you know, it's not a very stable system. It has the appearance of health, but not the reality of health, right? It's not a broad-based, mm-hmm. stable, lifts-all-boats kind of a thing. They just keep jacking up financial asset prices by printing money and throwing them into the markets. And it kind of keeps things together. I came across some things I wanted to get your reaction to, because, you know, you and I asked, what the heck happened in October 2023, right? What was that? Remember? And we're like, that's that green arrow. Like, this was really rolling over. And then it literally happened in the middle of the night between October 30th and November. All of a sudden, the stock futures just went the other way, and it just went this way, you know? And then we get to here. And look at this, right? That's what happened after that big print-a-thon or whatever happened in October of 23. That was the April taper tantrum. And here we are. But anyway, so this would be, but what was that? What caused that to everything to just violently reverse all of a sudden? Well, I came across a couple things. Turns out this is kind of cool. Here we're looking at financial conditions index, which is a measure of broadly how much liquidity is out there and how cheap is it and all that. So it's getting easier as this blue line goes up. So it's on this scale over here. And then the black is the ISM composite. So that's both services and manufacturing for the Institute of Supply, all that. So anyway, you can see they're pretty tightly correlated. But a couple things you'll notice here is that when this turns down, the ISM turns down, this followed afterwards, right? And then the black goes up first, and then the financial conditions follow. So normally, the financial conditions, if you track this along, sometimes it's leading, but for the most part, it's lagging. It's following this other thing. At any rate, here we are, October 23. It violently reversed the other direction, and really nothing happened to the ISM. It really didn't. That was a stock rally, not an economy rally. So I just found that interesting that we have this one data point here that, oh, look what happened here. Huh. And you know what's fascinating about that? I found this other one, which is banks reporting stronger demand for C&I loans, large firms and small firms. So they're large and small are pretty coincident. But you can see here, Paul, that every time that demand for loans has fallen off below this zero line in any significant way, you get these recessions, right? Yeah. You get this recession here because it dove off. Well, we had this huge dive off into October of 23, and then it violently reversed, but no recession. That's the first time we've ever had a minus 50 reading on loan demand, and without it signaling that there was actual economic weakness. So here's my theory, somebody just freaked out and threw a lot of money into the markets. A lot.
It sure looks that way. They did something to provide liquidity. Because, you know, what was it? Silicon Valley Bank went down because they speculated too heavily on 20 and 30-year treasuries, mm-hmm. and it took them down.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, on the other side of that, you don't hear anybody talking about, you know, the losses that the banks have on there. So I don't know what they did behind the scenes, but something certainly took place.
Something. Well, you know, it's all about liquidity, this, that, and the other thing. So we've got the Fed meeting, and, you know, are they going to cut? Are they going to cut a quarter point, a half point? You know, weird, because, you know, I know we're showing weakness now in housing and all that, and maybe they're looking at that too. But on paper, most expensive houses, inflation is not yet tamed. And Stocks at all-time highs are darn close, right? That's a weird yes. environment to say, here's our strong case for cutting.
Mm-hmm. It really is. Because, quite frankly, I mean, that's just going to further exacerbate the bubble. And I know there's people out there that really, you know, I had a debate with my brother-in-law not too long ago. They're all involved in real estate. And, you know, he's like, we got to cut, we got to cut, we got to cut. And I said, really, do we need to cut, right? I said, you know, we go through, stocks are at all-time highs, real estate's at all-time highs, gold's at all-time highs, everything's at all-time highs. Or do we just need to let the housing market settle back down so that the average person can afford a home again? And, you know, it led to a discussion that's like, well, he's like, well, you know, I really would love to have, you know, real estate continue because it's beneficial for me, but you got a good point. We, you know, the average individual is priced out of there, so maybe rates do need to stay a little bit higher for longer. And I just need to, you know, prepare for that. So, but it just doesn't seem like Trump seems bound and determined that we're going to get interest rates back down because he's a real estate guy. That's all he can think, that that's going to be the answer to solve everything. But the question is it going to work again? Can you kick this can down the road a lot longer just by dropping rates without having to print a bunch of money again? And what breaks on the other side of that?
So to be fair, the only thing the Fed really does when they cut their Fed fund rate is control the short end, like literally overnight right. money. That's just the shortest mm-hmm. of the short. So what Trump cares about is the 10-year bond, because that's where most mortgages are keyed off of that. And on that front, Paul, that's why I wanted to ask about this, because I think we have more concerning signs from longed bonds. So these are 10, 20, 30, 40-year paper. First off, Japan's 30-year paper looks like it's going to be breaking out. It's sort of bumping there at 3.178%. Mm-hmm. And then it just popped over that on August 20th, being today. So it broke out of that little thing. So for whatever reason, Japan's having a hard time controlling the long end of its curve. Germany, this made my eyebrows pop up. Look at the bid to cover on this, on their 30-year bond. So they had an auction. The bid to cover is how many bids did you get for the amount? So if you were offering $1 billion of bonds, if people bid for $2 billion and you only had $1 billion to sell, that's a 2-to-1 bid to cover. 1.033, that's as close to a failed auction as you can get. Germany yeah. almost had a failed 30-year bond auction.
Wow.
And it wow. stopped out. They were supposed to sell them at 3.22, and they had to sell them at 3.28. So not a good auction.
That's surprising. I'm surprised that anybody's going out there and buying the 30 years right now.
Me too.
Outside of a short-term position. Now, I'll say, we've got in our fixed income strategy, we've got the 20-year in there through TLT. We purchased it back at a decent support level after selling it a couple of years ago. But that's the most nervous position that I'm worried about, because it's sitting right on that level. Mm-hmm. And yes, we'll exit if it doesn't rally. It makes sense as a short-term trade, but there's no way that I would sell an individual bond and recommend it to somebody for 20 or 30 years and to set it on the shelf right now. Because we know what's going to happen if their only answer, if they don't allow things to settle down and prices to actually deflate, then they're going to have to print again. They're going to have to implement yield curve control and try to copy what Japan did for the longest time. And you're going to pee away your purchasing power with that part of your portfolio. It doesn't make sense to tie it up for that period of time, especially as a buy and hold position. It's that's ridiculously risky.
The only reason I would buy a 30-year bond from Germany for 3.28% is if I thought for sure I could sell it back to the German government at a higher price.
No, that's a good point.
Right?
Yeah.
Which they may yeah. have to do if they're doing the yield curve control. But just to note here, this is what it looks like if you're looking at the German bund yield here on the 30-year. This is the highest level it's been since 2011, which is a little while ago. But it's clearly going this way now, right? It went this way for a long time. Now it's going that way.
And that's a big deal. I mean, that's a big deal. Think about the individuals that bought that at a negative yield at that period of time, and the losses that they have on their paper right now, on their books. Yep. That's a lot.
By the way, I saw this, and this, turns out it was a misprint, but I found it funny. He said, is this a misprint, or did y'all lose another armada?
That's pretty good.
The Spain 10-year up 14% in an instant. So, well, this Kevin Malone, this is a lot of people reported on it. So I found Kevin. This ties into bonds. So I wanted to put it here to have a discussion about this. So the Federal Reserve's reverse repo, the RRP facility, it used to have a couple trillion in it, you know, and mm-hmm. now it's down to 22 billion. And so, you know, Kevin's asking, well, then what happens? And so this actually is a pretty big deal. This is a decent analysis of it. He said, okay, well, once that RRP is empty, there's no excess cushion left, right? Any new treasury issuance, the government selling bills to fund deficits, must be absorbed by private buyers instead of being offset by cash parked at the Fed. So this was, you see that bit, this going down from a little over $2 trillion all the way down? That was just $2 trillion in cash printed by the Fed, given to banks in the context of COVID, stuffed back at the Fed, and then used as a cushion to buy all the treasury paper that was coming out. Well, not all of it, but a good chunk of it. So he says, quote, that supply-demand imbalance can push yields higher, funding costs will rise, banks, hedge funds, and money market funds must compete harder for funding, repo rates, credit spreads start to creep up a little bit. So bottom line, when the RRP is falling like it is, you see that means liquidity is flowing into the markets, the liquidity, that famous liquidity, and short rates initially drop. And when it gets near zero, no excess cushion, new supply pushes yields higher, financial conditions tighten. So I think that could be a big deal going forward. I thought that was going to hit zero in March, but they've sort of been like easing it in there.
They have, for sure. That was a pretty good analysis of, because the repos, it's a hard thing to understand the impact that it has on the market, the reverse repo. But that was a good analysis and explanation. So we've got less cushion. You've got housing that's essentially frozen with prices starting to come down. And what's interesting to me is in our area in North Georgia, we're the last to turn up when housing took off. We're the last to turn down in 2007 because of who tends to be coming in this area. Mm-hmm. And we have the most listings that we've had in a long time. It's basically frozen. All the real estate agents are telling me that price is starting to drop across the board, and you can see those. So you got earnings, you know, but market's basically priced to perfection. So what's the next macro tailwind, right? What's the next AI theme that's going to continue to keep this euphoria going in the interim period? I'm having a hard time thinking of one right now, especially when we're coming into the season. We just had a huge revision in unemployment up, or jobs that they said we had that we didn't. And it's highly likely, based on a lot of the research that I've been looking at, that we're going to get more revisions going forward. So is the market going to continue to be able to price us in for Goldilocks if unemployment continues to rise? And we're already seeing that, you know, you shared the numbers in the last conversation that we had about, you know, college graduates are having a hard time finding a job. And consistently everywhere that I'm talking to individuals are surprised about if they've gotten laid off, they've not been able to find another job. I've had several individuals, even my daughter at this point, their company laid off a bunch of people and just rehired them at a lot less pay. So, yeah, across the board, and like everybody that was still staying with the company, you know, basically negotiated pretty substantial pay cuts across the board. So that's deflationary. And then at the same time, the lag from inflation, insurance policies are going up, taxes are going to go up across the board this year. Mm-hmm. So you've got less revenue coming in. But that inflation and that lag, especially in insurance and a lot of our basic costs for living, are continuing to go up. So this is not a good environment that we're walking in, that you want to be speculating that we're going to thread this needle perfectly.
Well, I agree. And I grabbed a little data about that in particular, about inflation. We'll talk about New Jersey's insurance thing. But first, the UK. This just came out this morning, UK winning again, serious reports writing here. The UK CPI was 3.8% versus expected 3.7 and previous 3.6. So heading in the wrong direction. That's the UK. But Paul, you and I have been talking about this part. And by the way, everybody's got a plan for higher inflation than expected, I think. So this just came out a couple days ago that rate filings show New Jersey. I don't know what's going on in New Jersey. I have no idea what it is, but Health insurance plans are set to soar in 2026. So Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield New Jersey, the biggest insurer in the marketplace, because they've got one of those government marketplaces for the ACA marketplaces, they're proposing an average increase of 17%. AmeriHealth, second biggest, proposing an average rate hike of 15.5. United Health, an average increase of 18.4. And they say here the premium increases coupled with the anticipated loss of federal subsidies means people are going to get hit with a double whammy, really. So I know you have to help people sort of navigate these sorts of things. Remember last time the government, Jolly Bilello showed that the government has claimed that actually health insurance is 19% less over the past 5 years, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
These are awful. Paul, 20% 15% increase is 15 into 70. So every 6 years, you're paying twice as much.
Mm-hmm.
5 years.
Yeah.
5 years.
Every 5 years. And that's the one thing. We've done a pretty good job of anticipating inflation for clients. But the one thing that I've underestimated in the past is, you know, 10% inflation for health insurance has not been enough. You know, whether it was the premiums or the extra office visits or everything that's been in there, that's the one thing that has continued to cause pain to a lot of individuals, especially those that are in a position to retire early.
That's crushing. It's just crushing. It's terrorizing for people, I'm sure. You know what they said in the article? They're like, well, you know, they gave four reasons. They said, well, inflation. They said healthcare providers' operational costs from labor shortages and wage increases and the cost of supplies has outpaced household inflation. Yeah, but not 17%. In fact,
no.
We should all have to. They should be forced to back that up. So if you go over, like I did, because I'm that kind of guy, to BLS and find out what's up. Well, medical care on commodities, Paul, is up 0.1% over the past 12 months. But medical care services is indeed up 4.3%, which is technically higher than CPI at 3.6% or whatever it is, 3.5% or whatever it's at. Not that much. It doesn't justify this sort of 17%, 15%, right? Then they said, well, you know, consumers are seeking more treatment for behavioral health, such as anxiety, depression, developmental disorders. Okay. Maybe we should talk about why we have such an unhappy culture right now. It's probably because of their health insurance bills, you know?
Yeah. Health insurance, food costs, vehicle costs.
Yep. And they say health plans report more patients being admitted to hospitals, and often they're sicker, requiring more intensive care. So what's driving that? Why are we sicker and requiring more care? And then this one drove me a little nuts because I did a report on the Wegovy, the GLP-1 today. Prescription drugs, they say health plans report seeing double-digit growth in medications such as GLP-1, which helps regulate blood sugar and promote weight loss. That's for most people, Paul, that is not a necessity. That is a lifestyle drug. I don't want to hear that my health plan went up 45%, 15%, 20%, whatever the numbers are, because some people want to get Wegovy face, you know?
My mind just splintered in about five different directions of things that I could say about that would offend just about every person, I guess, if we get there. But the reality is, yeah, lifestyle, we shouldn't have to pass that on, especially for those that are doing everything that they can to try to stay as healthy as they can. And put in the sacrifice in the interim period. But at the same time, you know, my question is this all about, hey, let's make sure the insurance companies cover a large majority of that so we can get big profits through the pharmaceutical companies? Because I'll tell you what happens is if the individuals had to pay for that themselves, they're not going to sell as much as those products. They're just not.
Yeah.
And that would drive the profits down or drive the sales down, and that's going to drive the profits down. So is it lobbying power that's pushing this? I mean, is that what this all boils down to? And every area, you've got these big corporations using their profit power, and they don't care if premiums go up for the average person 15 to 17%. I mean, that's horrible on the average individual, especially with all the other inflationary pressures that have come.
Yeah, you know, Trump did mention that he was going to, you know, cut pharmaceutical costs by 80% because we just get absolutely abused in this country. The pharma companies have proven to be nothing if not just abusive financially, right? And so often you'll find that something that costs a dollar or two in India might be $8,000 here. You know, I'm not kidding, right? There's one drug for a liver condition for Hep C that really actually works. It's $30,000 here. It's literally a couple bucks in India. So book yourself, if you have this condition, book yourself a nice trip to India, visit the Taj Mahal, go into a pharmacy, spend a couple bucks, get the job done. You know, but still, yeah. But the point is, like, we pay way more for those Wegovys than Europe. Like, a lot more. I don't want my rates to go up because we can't figure out how to not gouge ourselves for lifestyle drugs.
No, not at all. Hey, and my question is, I remember he made that statement, but I never did go back and follow up. Has he done anything to take action to reduce those prices at this point, or is it like a few other things we've been promised?
I think it's more of that. I haven't heard of anything. No follow-up on that.
I haven't either. So if it's coming through, I haven't seen anything or heard anything.
The markets are unraveling and the stakes could not be higher. If you're relying on passive strategies or so-called diversification, or perhaps using an advisor who was, I don't know, maybe in elementary school during the great financial crisis, you could be on a collision course with staggering portfolio losses. Peak Financial Investing is your lifeline. We handpick wealth managers who will actively manage your portfolio with proven, market-savvy strategies, not the tired modern portfolio theory that could crumble under pressure. The unprepared will not just lose this time, but lose big. The future that I see consists of both winners and losers, but many more losers this time than last time. Go to peakfinancialinvesting.com today and schedule your free consultation. This is your chance to protect your wealth. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. And I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, urging you, please, don't wait another day. You know, a lot of interesting things circulating around. Scott Bessent's really been hitting the trail. He had a bunch of things to come out. I have to ask if does he understand or respect capitalism? Very short clip here. Let's just listen in together.
Let's go back and look at the history, though, Becky. And look, China importing it is suboptimal. But if you go back and look pre-22, pre-invasion, 13% of China's oil was already coming from Russia. Now it's 16%. So China has a diversified input of their oil. If you go back and look now, I believe India had less than 1% of their oil, 1%, and now I believe it's up to 42%. So India is just profiteering, or they are just profiteering. They are reselling. They've made $16 billion in excess profits, some of the richest families in India. So this is a completely different thing. Like this India, what I would call the Indian arbitrage, buying cheap Russian oil, reselling it as product, has just sprung up during the war, which is unacceptable.
Unacceptable that a country is making its own decisions and making money while doing it. Unacceptable. And these are wealthy families, don't you understand?
Oh yeah, it's all the normal propaganda there to demonize the individuals for making moves that make sense from something that the U.S. created from their sanctions.
Yeah, no, we created it. So the responses were just brutal. Scott Ritter, who I think people may know, he said, quote, "But still, Mr. Bessent, not as bad as blowing up a pipeline to deny Europe cheap Russian gas and then turning around and selling Europe U.S. gas at significant markups. Talk about opportunistic arbitrage."
Oh, that was good. That was good.
Ouch. And Cato the Younger said, "Well, who are you to dictate to other countries how they care for their own country? Sounds very imperial colonialist." And SRS Rocco Steve writes, "Someone needs to tell the U.S. Treasury Secretary that the global oil industry is fungible." Which, thank you, Steve, for that, because this whole idea is like, oh, but they only took 1%, and now it's 16% of the oil. This is terrible. It's like the oil market is fungible. Like 100% of it gets consumed. It comes out of the ground, and it gets used. Whether 8% went here, it's a fungible market. It's just, anyway, it's just, there we are shaking our rattles and sabers at another country, and I don't know.
It's interesting. It seems that too often, I guess I'm not old enough to have seen a politician or somebody get into a position of power and actually be excited about what they've done on the other side. It seems to be this major flip once they get in there, this completely opposite of what they say they're going to do before they go in. And that's on both sides, right? That's on both sides.
Well, this is fascinating because the reason I brought this in is because you and I touched on it briefly, but I'm starting to see a pattern. And so what Scott Bessent said is deeply non-free market, non-capitalism.
Yes. Right?
He's starting to denigrate making profits. And, you know, it's like that's a weird thing for a guy who used to work for a large hedge fund. Thought you would get that. But then we also saw that, of course, the Trump administration had said that NVIDIA can't sell their H100 chips to China. It's a security issue. Oh, unless you give us a cut, 15%, right?
Yeah.
And then they said, well, we're going to take a stake in Intel, right? We're going to this is the early steps of what I would call nationalizing key industries. It's an aspect of corporatism. So Scott Bessent suddenly can't separate policy from capitalism. And it's getting tangled all of a sudden. So I'm wondering what's going on here.
That's a good question. That's a real good question. Because, you know, and I thought about that as you were talking about that, him being a hedge fund manager. He's going to capitalize. I'm sure he spent his career capitalizing on those arbitrage opportunities. But you're going to demonize somebody else for doing it in an environment that our country established for a country that's got their own citizenry they've got to watch out for. You know, I mean, all of us, if we have an opportunity to take advantage of something that is structured in there that's morally correct. That's my number one rule, to help shelter your own family a little bit and then your neighbors and others that you can advise to participate, and that is going to do it. I mean, that's, you should do that. I mean, that's just being prudent and a good fiduciary. So I had not heard that. I'm absolutely blown away by that statement.
I know. I'm not sure what's happening. Out here in the cheap seats, it's starting to feel a little like I don't quite understand what's happening. There must be something. I hope there's something more elegant behind the scenes. I hope there's a plan here. But that's the kind of stuff, you know, that ultimately ends up making people like India, proud people, unhappy. They just feel like they're being talked down to and sort of scolded for doing the same things we do. They didn't create the condition. They didn't say, hey, you know, it'd be a great idea. Let's provoke Russia into a war, and then you know, I have to pay the price because you guys, what? You know, it's a weird thing.
Right.
You know?
It is a very weird thing. It's a weird thing, but it fits the propaganda again. You know, and going back to what, it was just a few years ago that the energy companies, they were talking about taxing their profits because they were profiting off of a short-term opportunity, and then you look at the fact that you know, you've highlighted clearly the energy issues that we're running into for lack of investment, you know, because you've demonized those companies. So capital is not easy for them to get. It's hard to get. And that's, you clearly documented and shown that people are going to pay the price for not listening to the things that you're warning them about when it comes to what's going to happen to energy in the future, energy prices. And for those of us that are able to see and jump on that opportunity, it'll help shelter our families from the damage that's going to come on the other side of that as well.
So these are really bizarre, destructive policies. So the North Sea operator is now calling for an overhaul because the UK put this windfall tax on oil prices. And a windfall is supposed to be like, it means an excessive profit that didn't materialize as a result of anything you did. It was just a random circumstance, you know, and therefore it somehow seems illegitimate. And the government of UK said, well, then that's ours. Problem is oil's fallen to such a spot that they can't support their new drilling. And the government's, of course, still wants their fair share of the windfall, even though there's no windfall right now. It's actually so it's, of course, doing what? Inhibiting more development and capital investment, which will make the country poorer. So the government's going to have to figure out new ways to tax other things that still aren't dead yet. I mean, I think that's the plan.
Windfall tax. That was what I couldn't bring to mind right there. But yeah, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, it's this narrative central planning control, and we're supposed to be a free economy. We're not supposed to be communists in central planning, whether it's corporatism or however that is.
Yeah.
And yeah, it may look good in the interim period because you can cause the markets to defy gravity for a while with a handful of companies. But you're not going to avoid that pain because reality, the truth is going to come back at some point. You know, that old thing, weak individuals, weak men and women create hard times create good men and women, strong men and women who create good times. And we're certainly in the weak leadership standpoint. And even as a society, individuals, there's a lot of weakness in all of us that we have to choose to to make those good decisions and seek the path of truth and wisdom and pursue that, because that's the only thing that's going to stand the test of time.
Well, now, so Paul, I've been talking with more and more people who are concerned that something doesn't feel right, and they'd like to be more diversified, more set. Some of them feel trapped in 401ks that are sort of defined, what the universe of things that they can actually invest in from their company or whatever is pretty limited. So people are having a lot of questions about that. And so I'm hoping, are you going to be talking about this at the summit in September?
Yes. So if I understand correctly, we're doing two talks. One's
doing two talks.
Yeah, I'm doing two talks. So one's going to be everything that you need to know about retirement. Now, it's not going to be boring at all because, you know, most people have spent their life accumulating assets. When you go into the distribution phase, you have a completely different set of weaknesses that can wipe you out. Like, it's a different strategy when you get into that distribution phase. Different strategy. You can have the same strategy, but downside risk management is extremely important. So we're just going to get into the overview and kind of cover some concepts. People are going to walk away from there knowing more than what most financial advisors know, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had anybody complain about that. And we're going to do questions and answers. And then the next one is we're going to get into the weeds and the details. Kind of what do you do in this market environment, right? There's incredible risks, and especially in the U.S. markets from an evaluation standpoint. But there's also incredible opportunities out there, whether it's energy or commodities or emerging markets. I mean, the good thing about the distortion that we have in the economy right now is there are unbelievable opportunities that could be life-changing for families. So we're going to get into, in that second talk, we're going to get into the weeds. Any question that you want to ask, we'll, you know, I'll try to keep the lingo as simple as possible. But, you know, how do you navigate? How do you take advantage of opportunity and share ideas on what people can do? There's several different ways that you can approach it and, you know, talk about these things so that people are better prepared, better informed, and wiser to navigate the days ahead. I mean, one of the prayers that I always ask, and it made me happy for my kids to say it now when they pray from time to time, is, Lord, please grant us wisdom and prudence for the days ahead. So that's everything that we're going to be covering, is just trying to get the truth of where we are and help people be better armed so that they can make wiser decisions with their resources, whether they're managing it themselves, whether they're working with somebody that they can, you know, they've had a relationship with a long time, or whether it's us. I want it to be something that arms people to navigate the days ahead better. And both of the sessions that we're doing will do that.
I'm really looking forward to those myself. And so anybody who's listening to this, if you want to attend, you could go to peakprosperity.com, and there's a banner up there, and you can find tickets to this thing. It's going to be a good time, Paul, and I can't wait to see you. Can't wait to see everybody. It's family time, you know. And the most relieving thing, of course, is to be around people who you can have these open conversations with about all of it, right?
Yes. You
know, the reality of it all. So, time to square up to reality. I'm looking forward to it.
And I want to share just from my experience of all the conferences that I go to. You know, a lot of times you'll go to a conference and there's boundaries around conversation. Like, people are, you know, don't quite have the courage to delve into something because they're afraid somebody's going to be offended is not the right word. Or they're, you know, they'll kind of look foolish, I guess, is the best way to explain it. The thing I love about the annual summit, and then when you had it at your farm, and then I'm looking forward to this year. I mean, people have open, honest conversations because nobody, you know, everybody's seeking the truth that's there. I didn't meet one single person that didn't have the courage. And that's one thing I've always tried to encourage people, and what I remind myself on a daily basis, is seek the truth, have the courage to follow the truth wherever it will take you, and then seek the wisdom that truth can give you. And that's one thing. No matter where I went, I enjoyed the conversations. You'd pop up, you know, I'd walk out of one and be in a destination to the other. I was late everywhere I went because I'd walk through and hear something and I'm like, oh, can I join in for a minute? You know? So I encourage people, if you care about the truth, you're wanting to be resilient for the future. It's one of the most enjoyable things that I've ever attended. And the scenery is beautiful. The fellowship is great. The conversations are incredible. I mean, even the talks that I attended, the conversations were just as informative as the talks. And then even the conversations that were spurred by the lectures and talks were just as good as, you know, the talks did what they were supposed to do, got people talking to try to be more resilient. So I don't want to talk about it too much, but I can tell you, I look forward to it and I thoroughly enjoy it.
Well, thank you for that. And yes, we'll be talking all things financial and resilience related too. It's just time to be resilient. I mean, if I had to sort of characterize how I'm seeing that the dots line up right now is, we're going to go through a rough patch here, right? I do think there's better times on the other side. I'm actually already starting to get pretty greedy because I know there's really good prices for some things coming. You know, there's some stories that the general mass don't have right that, you know, I think we can see coming, particularly in commodities and hard assets and things like that. But we'll have those discussions there too.
Yeah, and that's the thing I want to point out is I'm not completely negative. I'm heartbroken over the fact that we're in the situation that we're in economically, and I know the pain that it's going to cause a lot of people who just aren't aware of where we are and what's coming, right? And then I also worry about the lack of emotional strength just in our society today anyway. So I think it's going to be a lot harder on people emotionally, because the one thing that I have the benefit of seeing, I started my career in 98. So I saw that, you know, that original bubble. I saw the damage that the 2000 to 2003 did. I was with a corporate firm that was, you know, buy, no matter what's happening. There was no attempt to try to protect people against what was happening. The whole attempt with the corporate Wall Street model is gather assets. And they don't seem to care if this group of individuals is wiped out because they're trying to gather assets. For them, they make up for it. But there's a trail of individuals that their lives were completely changed because of a lack of understanding of history and a hell of a sales pitch, right? Mm-hmm. And then we went through 2008, and I'll never forget, you know, our strategy did good, and we sidestepped 2008, and I go home, tell my wife, like, this is going to be fun. But the fear that was on the other side of that, even with the individuals, the fear in the midst of it trickled into everybody. Even the people that we navigated it well, I mean, they came through it unscathed, were absolutely terrified because of the damage that they saw take place. And, you know, like I think I said it last time, you know, there are people that were wiped out in that 2007, 2008, you know, they're 65, they're 70, they're 75, their health isn't good enough to be able to go back to work, and their lives were dramatically changed. They weren't going to Rotary anymore. They weren't going to the Optimist Club. They weren't able to volunteer. You know, they had to cut back. They just kind of slid out of society. So I've had the benefit of my career of seeing the damage that these major market downturns can ensue to people and their lives and their families and the divorces that come on the other side of it from the financial stress that comes through, the embarrassment that they deal with, the suicides that people should not have gone through. And we were fortunate that none of our clients did that. But in a small community, especially because we sidestepped, I had all kinds of conversations with of individuals trying to help them make wise decisions to recover from what occurred to them in those major declines. So I know the damage. And that's the thing I tell people. You know, for 27 years, I've helped walk people through retirement. I know what you're going to face, the potholes, and I've been around the corners that you're going to have to go around, and I have a good idea as to what you're going to be facing. And it's not necessarily rocket science, but there's wisdom to be able to be shared, because I can tell you, if people have a decent return as time goes along, and they don't run out of money before they retire, and they don't get forced to change their lifestyle dramatically, that's a successful retirement. A little bit of missed opportunity because you're prudent is not life-changing. But when you're speculating and you don't realize it, and you get sold a bag of goods to promise a future so that somebody can gather some assets, and it comes apart, that's life-changing. And nobody's going to loan you money in retirement, right? I always tell people, if you're doing your plan and you plan for you first, because your kids, when they get to college, I know it's your desire to pay for your kids' college, right? But they've got opportunity. They can work their way through and pay. It may take them a little bit longer. They can get student loans. They can do all of these things. But if you're 75 years old and you make a major mistake, nobody's going to loan you money to give you the income you need to live the lifestyle that you need throughout retirement. There's just no safety net there outside of what you implement yourself or the strategies that you're implementing to help mitigate that worst case scenario, the one thing that can take you out. So that's why I spend so much time taking people through actual history and stress testing them to say, hey, what can take you out? What can cause you to have an upended retirement? Your dream of retirement turned into the nightmare of what you don't want it to be. And these major market downturns are the things that can wipe people out. And especially one thing I saw is investors in 2008, you know, I'll never sell a dip. Well, emotions take over. You know, it was one thing when they went through the 87 crash or the 2000 crash while they were still working. It's an, you know, and you're not, you know, you're happy to keep your job or you're looking for another job. It's another thing when you're 10 years into retirement, you can't imagine going back to work. The fear of those market downturns is magnified times 100. So that's everything that we do is to try to help people prepare, think ahead. You know, it doesn't matter how successful a strategy can be if failure is too costly to bear. And so I'm so concerned about the potential risks that people are carrying in their portfolios right now, and they just don't know. I mean, all the statistics tell us the baby boomers have the highest equity rating that they, you know, any retirement age group has ever had. So that means they're at the most risk of damage to their financial situation in a market that is the most expensive market in history, compared to 29, 2000, even the 2022 top. We're breaking records across the board right now. So you better hope it's not, you better hope it is different this time if you don't have a risk managed strategy, because hope's not an investment strategy. I mean, we hope that things are good. We hope that good planning produces good fruit. But the part is good planning, strategies, adaptation, that can give you hope. If you don't have a, if your hope is to just, hey, the government's going to bail us out, then there's a lot of governments throughout history that people put their faith in that if they had their life to do over again, they would not have put the faith there that they did. So that's the reason why pursuing wisdom, truth, and disciplined strategies can make a big difference. Buffett's been successful because he's run a disciplined strategy. Yes, he came through the single greatest bull market that we've seen throughout the U.S. market history. He would have done good, but he did great because he implemented a risk management, you know, I say risk managed, he's lowering risk in the portfolio, so he's managing risk, but a value strategy, paid attention to fundamentals and mathematics, and then made those investments based on discipline and then hoped that they panned out. There's a big difference. There's two types of hope. Hope because you put the work in, and that's the good kind of hope. The hope without work that it's just going to pan out, that's not the type of hope that's an investment strategy that can stand the test of time.
Well, for everybody listening, normally over Paul's shoulder, instead of the history of bubbles, it says...
invest your plan, not your emotions.
Right, invest your plan. So the plan is the important part here. If you want to talk to Paul and his amazing team and get a plan where you have a strategy that is battle tested and you understand really what risks you're taking, I highly advise that you do that. And I'm going to go further and say you should do that before things really start coming apart. It's a very normal thing. People, hey, everything's fine right now, Chris. I feel pretty good. But I'll tell you this, that when it starts to fall apart, a lot of people get the same idea at the same time, which is like, oh, now I should do something. And of course, now you'll be in a queue with other people and getting frantic as you hope to rush a process that should never be rushed. So go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form and get the process started right away. No obligation, but it's a very comprehensive process that Paul will run with you. He and his team, just get the plan and see what the plan tells you. It's so worth it. Again, peakfinancialinvesting.com. With that, Paul, hey, thanks for your time today. And
it's always a pleasure, Chris.
Have a great weekend.
A pleasure. You too.